Hello, this is Claire Levy. Coming up in this edition of the DRWF podcast, Living with Diabetes, we have the latest instalment of our special series of programmes looking specifically at women's health. In this episode, I've been talking to Greta Earls, who's living with type 1. She's a big advocate for tech and encourages innovation in diabetes management to make it less intrusive.
They took a finger prick. And I don't remember the number, but it was somewhere way too high. And then I didn't remember that much, but they basically said, we need to rush you to hospital and you'll have to take injections for the rest of your life. I remember that sentence very clearly. And when you are 9 years old, it's absolutely terrifying. School was okay. I think I got like the odd comments from the boys, you know, giving me like weird like names. I was always like, I don't know if I get drunk, whether I'm still aware of the thing that I have to manage that could potentially be life-threatening.
So how quickly would you mention to somebody that you're living with type 1 and how quickly does that impact on, say, a sexual relationship?
Yeah, I'm very open. I've always been open with that. I mean, I have the devices on my arm, but for me, it's part of me. If somebody has a problem, then leave me alone, like date someone else. That's what I asked actually online. I was like, what do you guys do with your insulin pump when you have sex? It's a topic that's not really considered a lot when we talk about diabetes management, even though sex is such a key part of general well-being.
Hear the full interview coming up next.
Views, information, or opinions contained in podcasts do not necessarily represent the opinions, standards, or policies of DRWF. The inclusion of details about products or services does not indicate DRWF endorsement of them. The aim of podcasts is to educate and inform, and we endeavour to ensure that the information provided in them is accurate. It's not a substitute for medical or health advice from a healthcare professional who's aware of the facts and circumstances of your individual situation. We always recommend that advice be sought from your GP or diabetes nurse before making any changes to medication or before using any products or services referenced by DRWF. Neither DRWF nor any of its employees or owners shall be held liable or responsible for the accuracy or completeness, for any errors or omissions in podcasts, or for any damage you may suffer as a result of failing to seek competent medical or health advice from a professional who is familiar with your situation.
Welcome, Greta Earls. Greta's a med tech professional and speaker driven by a mission to ignite innovation in the field of diabetes technology. Could you introduce yourself to us and tell us a little bit about yourself and your career?
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me. Pleasure. I'm Greta. I am passionate about many things. One of them is diabetes tech, diabetes awareness, helping startups get their solution off the ground and make a difference for people living with diabetes like myself. I also love traveling, good coffee, scuba diving. I'm currently prepping for my dive master, which is also quite a funny thing with type 1 diabetes, actually, and meeting very interesting people all over the world.
Brilliant. So today we're talking a lot about living with all forms of diabetes. Can you just talk through your early experiences being diagnosed with type 1 diabetes? What was that like and what happened to you?
Absolutely. So I think looking back, I really had all the symptoms that I tell you about in the books. So I was 9 years old. I was on summer holiday with my best friends without my parents. And I don't remember too much from that holiday, but I remember that I couldn't sleep because I had to go to the bathroom every couple of minutes. And I was tired all the time and thirsty. And I could drink glasses and glasses of water and it wouldn't help. And then I got back and my parents hadn't seen me in like 10 days and they were like, oh, you lost a lot of weight. But I obviously had been eating normally. So I think we all were a bit like something's off, and then the excessive drinking of water continued and all of that. So they took me to a doctor and they took a finger prick. And I don't remember the number, but it was somewhere way too high. And then I don't remember that much, but they basically said, we need to rush you to hospital and you'll have to take injections for the rest of your life. I remember that sentence very clearly. And when you are 9 years old, it's absolutely terrifying.
How did you deal with that knowledge then at nine?
I think so. I stayed in hospital, I think, for like around 2 weeks. And honestly, I had a great time. There were really nice nurses, nice doctors, other kids around me that were around the same age that got the same diagnosis. They had foosball. I loved it. You know, my family would come, my friends would come with like presents. I'm like, this is great. and I guess I didn't really realize back then what it would mean when you're 9 years old. It's kind of like, okay, they taught me how to inject myself and do the finger pricks and carb count and all of that. And somehow I don't really remember it as being something very annoying. I think I was just like, okay, I guess that's what I have to do now. And it was really just that somehow, I think.
Did your family have any experience? Did they have any knowledge, or were they on that learning curve as well?
No, there's no one in my family who had it. I think we didn't know anyone who had it. So I think for my parents, I think my parents were the ones who had to deal with it, because I was so little. For me, it was like, okay, but I think my parents were the ones reading all the books and trying to understand what it means. And they did a great job telling me or showing me that it isn't the end of the world, you know, like, a couple of weeks after I got out of hospital, one of my best friends was celebrating their birthday. And I thought, obviously, in the beginning, that that means I can't have cake or something. And my parents were like, no, have as much chocolate cake as you like, but just make sure that you inject yourself before that. And they've done an amazing job with always making me feel like I can still do anything as long as I keep that thing in mind, which is like the extra bit of work. So I think they had to do a lot of reading and learning, and they did an amazing job kind of telling me what to do, but keeping it very like relaxed. I never felt like it was a big deal. It was just like, okay, this is what we have to do now. And I guess back then I couldn't really comprehend it means the rest of my life. I didn't really think that's maybe what you think as a 9-year-old, but it wasn't like a huge terrifying thing, I think, once I kind of came out of hospital and stuff. I feel like life just continued as it did before.
Have you spoken to them about it since, now you're an adult, about what they went through? Do they ever talk about it?
Yeah, I asked them because I was very interested, because I don't remember a lot what happened. I remember the hospital very clearly, and then after, it's just this thing I always had. I don't really remember life before that. And I asked them, how did I do after I got back home? I was like, did I do what I have to do? Was I sad? And they were like, no, you were really just, okay. And I don't remember that. I was like, okay, it's like interesting for me to know, but they're like, no, you really didn't make a big deal out of it, and neither did we. And I guess that somehow helps. And for them, they said, yeah, it was a lot of reading, because obviously there were no apps and all of that. Not really. Back then, we got a huge book with like pages and pages of food ingredients and the neutral score and all of that. But I think they're also quite pragmatic in that way. I think they're like, we have to do it and we might as well make the best out of it, I guess. Yeah.
So early life wasn't too bad, and school was okay, was it? Peers at school, were they okay?
School was okay. I think I got like the odd comments from the boys, you know, giving me like weird like names because of the... So in German, I grew up in Germany, there's this word, it's basically the German word for sugar, which is a slang word for diabetes. It's called sugar sickness. And there's loads of funny word games with it. But somehow I was always like, ugh, I didn't really get sad, or I didn't really feel bullied or something. I was just like, you're stupid, leave me alone. So I don't really think that kind of impacted me, and teachers and my friends around me did an amazing job. So school's fine, actually. I don't really remember it being a big deal somehow.
Did you know anybody else?
No one. I mean, the hospital I went to, and the doctors that treated me, because I would go every 3 months for the checkups, they would organize these summer camps. And my parents asked me, like, do you want to go? And I was like, absolutely not. Sounds like my nightmare on earth, going to a summer camp with a bunch of sick kids. I'm like, no, sounds boring. So they're like, okay, we're not going to force you. You're doing well. So I didn't really feel like I wanted to meet other kids, I guess, with diabetes. And that was fine for most of the time. But I think I realized more like 10 years later that I really didn't have anyone to talk to that isn't my nurse or my endocrinologist. So when I was a kid, I didn't really care. I think it came later that I was like, oh, it would be helpful to talk to someone who's going through the same things.
So yeah, those changes maybe when you were a little bit older. So yeah. So what did you do then to find a sort of support group amongst? Was it girls going through puberty or was it a bit of both?
Yeah, I think it was even later than that. Somehow I really didn't think so much about it, like even when I was a teenager. And then I had a very like frustrating point when I was like 18 or something, because I think it never really hit me as a kid, the whole thing of like, oh, I have to do this now. But then I think it came a bit later. And I had so many questions that I wanted answers to, and my HCPs couldn't really give them to me. And then I was like, oh, I think now it will help speaking to someone else. And then I opened an Instagram account. I knew from some people that there's like quite a big online community. And I'm like, okay, Instagram was a huge thing anyway, so I might as well just do a diabetes Instagram. And then that really changed a lot, because I, in days, you know, met a lot of people who are like, oh yeah, this is not just a me thing, this is like 50 other people who I met within 48 hours who are going through the same thing. And I think whenever I had questions that aren't strictly related to like my insulin pump or something, these were the people that had the answers I needed. Because most, and I think all of the healthcare professionals and endocrinologists, they didn't have diabetes themselves. So they know what's in the books, I guess, but they don't know the living reality of type 1 diabetes, whereas these people did.
And what issues did you find as you got later, as you got older maybe then?
I think it's like a couple of different things. And so when I was 13, 14, I definitely had a phase where I was in this absolute denial. I mean, back then we didn't have a Dexcom and stuff that would track everything. We had a paper book and finger pricks. And for a couple of weeks, I was just like, I'm just not going to do this. It's kind of like out of sight, out of mind. I'm like, if I don't know that my blood sugar is high, then I don't care. And I would just put little fake numbers into my book. And then obviously after 3 months, I'd see my doctor who was checking my A1C. And he's like, that does not match at all. I don't know what math you've been doing there, but the blood sugar, the glucose values in your journal really don't match your A1C. And then I think he talked to my parents and was like, something's going on. And then my dad talked to me. He's like, hey, I know that it sucks, but you're only going to harm yourself if you keep doing this. And somehow this really made sense. I'm like, I guess I wanted to annoy everyone around me by not doing what I'm supposed to, but I didn't really realize that I'm the one who's gonna face the consequences like 30 years later. And it helped me to know that other people have gone through the same thing. I think this was more like a puberty thing, but then I started to travel. There's like loads of additional things you have to deal with when you travel. Sex, menstruation, and anything really. Like I felt burned out, you know. I was like, there's this thing and none of my friends have to deal with that. And even though they've all always been incredibly understanding, they will never know what it really feels like, you know, like having a night of hypos and then having to function the next day. And then that really helped, being like, yeah, we know how that feels. And have you tried this or this, or this helps me? That was good. Yeah.
I mean, a lot of young people, I think they find it difficult when they first go off to university, for example, mm-hmm. because everybody's out drinking and partying and eating what they want, or probably not eating very well at all. Mm-hmm. Did you find that was an issue?
I've been incredibly careful with alcohol. Maybe as a context, I grew up on the Bavarian countryside. People start drinking beer very early. and I was always like, I don't know if I get drunk, whether I'm still aware of the thing that I have to manage that could potentially be life-threatening. I mean, if you look at the symptoms of someone who's really drunk and the symptoms of someone who's really low blood glucose, that's scarily similar, right? And I've heard about cases where somebody would have a hypo and like wasn't taken seriously because it's like, oh, they're just drunk. And I was like, if I'm drunk, do I still remember that I need to check? Can I tell the difference between being tipsy and feeling shaky because my blood glucose is dropping? So I've been very much like careful with that. But somehow, and I don't really know why, I've never envied the people around me that did do it. I was just like, it's my decision. I could if I wanted, but I guess I didn't really want to let go of that sort of control. Because I knew there was no, I didn't have a Dexcom until I was, I think, 20 maybe. That's changed a lot of things. But if you don't have that and you're kind of out clubbing and then you have to be on the dance floor and what, do like a finger prick and put that thing in and then like wait with your little blood glucose meter and try to read what it says on the dance floor, that just seemed annoying, to be honest.
So tell us something then about your tech and what a difference that's made to your life.
I think that you just know what's going on at all times. I mean, made a huge difference during the night. I always struggled with like low blood glucose during the night and the dawn phenomena where it just, you know, goes up randomly at like 4 a.m. even though I'm fast asleep. And that changed things. And I think also that thing that I don't need to remember or remind myself to check. You know, like if I had a busy day, I would realize, oh, I haven't checked my blood glucose in 8 hours back when I only had finger pricks. And then suddenly that was gone and you could just check your reader or your phone. And I think that made it less on my mind to a certain extent. Because you knew once the CGMs with the alarms came, you knew that I don't have to check it because as long as it doesn't make a sound, I'm good. I think it took off quite a lot of mental load somehow.
And you mentioned about sex and menopause. And so how quickly would you mention to somebody that you're living with type 1 and how quickly does that impact on, say, a sexual relationship?
Yeah, I'm very open. I've always been open with that. I mean, I have the devices on my arm, but for me, it's part of me. If somebody has a problem, then leave me alone and like date someone else. I think I've always been quite like, I've never been ashamed of my diabetes ever. I've not had a single day where I felt ashamed. And I think that made it easier for me to be like, see, that's the deal. And that's what you need to know. So for me, it's never really been a problem. Funnily enough, the first time I felt more conscious about it is when I switched from MDI to a pump. So I was on MDI for 18 years until I switched. I only switched to a pump like 3 years ago. And then suddenly I was more aware that there's like a tube with a needle and like a device kind of like always in the way. So that was funny that came like in my late 20s where I was like, oh, this is like the first time. It was a bit awkward. I'm like, what do I do? And that's what I asked actually online. I was like, what do you guys do with your insulin pump when you have sex? Do you just leave it there? But then it's somewhat annoying. But then if you disconnect it, you don't get your insulin. So what do you do? And that was funny. That came later. It's quite an individual experience, I think. I know people that feel more like ashamed because it's something additional to handle. And I really like bringing up the conversation around diabetes and sex because somehow sex is a topic that's not really considered a lot when we talk about diabetes management, even though sex is such a key part of general well-being. And there's a lot of extra things to think about when you have diabetes are sexually active and you get diagnosed with diabetes. I mean, there's all the parts of like vascular damage and that people with diabetes have more, I don't like sexual problems, but like you might not orgasm as easily. You might not feel as much. Can I check?
Of course you can, yeah, check away.
Speaking of. Let me just. It's another thing that's, I threw my pump in the corner the other day because it was annoying me and now I'm back on injections.
Did you break it?
No, but I wish I did.
Is there anything else you want to talk about with sexual health? Have you talked to older people maybe and their sexual health and their diabetes? Is that a conversation that comes up?
I think it's more like peers in my age group. I think there's a difference between the like vascular damage kind of conversation that pops up a lot and the mental load because it's not as easy to let go, and also let go of the fact that there's this thing next to the bed that might vibrate or beep, or you get shaky and you're like, sorry, I need to have some jelly beans while you're like sleeping with someone, you know? I understand people who feel awkward about that. I don't think it should be a taboo topic, but it's something that my endocrinologist has never discussed with me. I'm not sure whether I want to discuss it with them, but it's not never a conversation that pops up somehow, even though it takes so much space in our day-to-day life, because it is something that's kind of like, you know, in there, up there in your head 24/7. And I think when we talk about sex and diabetes, that should be a conversation we should have more often, and especially for people that are even younger, and they're like 16, 17 or something, and you maybe have your first sexual experiences, and either you get diagnosed before that and then you have this thing that you've always been managing, or you get diagnosed later on and then suddenly there's this additional thing to think about. So I think I'm a big fan of opening up this conversation because it's not spoken about enough.
Mm. What about your work at DC Burn? Can you tell us a bit about that and around menstruation and diabetes?
Yes. So the DCB is a nonprofit foundation in Switzerland. And what we do is research in diabetes, and we want to translate this research into solutions out there on the market that help people with diabetes. So this is where all the startups come in that I work with or like scout for. And we have a new project, which is about menstrual cycle, because it's often been overlooked. I mean, there's research shows that more women than men use insulin pumps, and we're having this whole conversation about closing the loop. Yet menstrual cycle has been ignored for years. And you can't close a loop. You can't have something where the person with diabetes doesn't have to interfere with the system if you ignore this whole topic that concerns almost half of the population, right? So there's not a lot of data on it, and we want to kind of close this gap by looking at how menstruation impacts insulin treated diabetes. So it can be type 1 but can also be type 2.
Sure. Yeah. And is there anything there in those startups, the sort of tech and what you're looking to fund or help to get going?
So I think for us, the menstrual cycle project is a research project as of now. It's about collecting data to see how it is related. I didn't know that until quite recently, that during your menstrual cycle, obviously your hormones change. And if you during your ovulation, your hormones might go up, and that means that you are more insulin resistant. And that means that suddenly you need X amount more insulin to go back in range than compared to a week ago. And then once your hormones drop in the beginning of your cycle, suddenly you have a lot of hypos, because now you for 5 days you've been injecting more insulin, and then suddenly your hormones drop and you end up in hypos several times a day. And that's just not really been explored. I know that it's very individual, you know, for every person, but still I think there needs to be more research done to see how it is linked. And then I think once we have data, we can translate it into to startups and solutions out there, especially I think when it comes to AID systems. So where it's a huge conversation about how can we not announce meals. There's a lot of conversations about how can we skip announcing meals for people with diabetes, but that's not the only thing. And then people talk about exercise, and I'm like, yeah, but hormones actually impacted hugely.
Do you see any differences living and working in Switzerland for the diabetes care? Do you compare that and contrast it to other countries like the UK?
In terms of living with diabetes?
Yeah, and care and support.
Yeah,
and
so I've never lived in the UK, actually, okay. So I don't really know. I've lived in Germany, in Sweden, Denmark, but all like kind of Scandinavian countries and Switzerland, and I think we are incredibly privileged when it comes to access to tech and care. It's super easy to get a pump in Switzerland. It's easy to get the system that you want. There's a lot of systems available in Switzerland. So I know from other people, even in Germany, for example, it's harder to switch Once you've signed a contract with a pump, you can't really get out of it, whereas in Switzerland, that's very easy. And it's funny for me because I love moving country. I always think about where could I go next. But now I'm so spoiled when it comes to getting the tech I want, you know, and then I wasn't a pump. I didn't like it. After a year, I switched to another one. It wasn't even a big deal. My doctor just signed a letter saying it's for medical reasons, and I was out. And now I'm like, wow, this is the care and the access to tech we have in Switzerland is incredible. Makes it really hard to kind of go from there, I guess.
Yeah. Is that something that comes up on social media conversations?
Yes, I think access, I mean, I talk about access to tech that doesn't even, I mean, access to insulin is a whole different topic. I mean, I talk about that we don't get the tech we want. There's people all over the world that don't get insulin. So I think that's a big conversation, the access to insulin, also compared Europe to the United States, for example.
So people living with type 1 diabetes, what can they do to improve care and how do their voices work to make a difference, do you think?
I always say that I don't think it's so much on the people with diabetes. It's on the big companies and the startups that foster new solutions to involve us. And I get a bit angry sometimes because they think it's like so obvious that we want to like jump on all these calls and help. But somehow a lot of input from people with diabetes is kind of like taken for granted. Either it's taken for granted and it's expected to be done for free because you're the one who wants the solution, you should contribute, or they're not being asked at all. And I talk to a lot of startups, I look at a lot of pitch decks, and sometimes I ask these people, have you asked anyone with diabetes whether they would use it? Because it seems like an absolute pain, your solution. I don't really see why it would make anything better. They're like, yes, yes, we've talked to people. I'm like, who? They're like, yeah, two people in our family. I'm like, that is great. I mean, it's not going to get you very far, but okay. And I think I want more feedback from people with diabetes in the entire process. Don't just involve them when you've already frozen your design, you know, in the like regulatory process. Involve them from the beginning. That's what we do at the DCB as well. I mean, we have some people with diabetes on the team. So whenever we work with startups, there's at least like three people involved that live with diabetes. We have a lived experience panel because it's important to involve the people you want to design a solution for. And I think it's not being done enough somehow. And at the same time, it's hard because it is such an individual thing, right? I mean, what works for one person absolutely doesn't work for the other person and the other way around. I know people who've been on a pump all their life, and they're like, I could never do MDI. And I know people who do MDI and they're like, I would never use a pump. So I think it's important to remember that it's very individual.
One size doesn't fit all, is yes, what we always say.
Exactly.
What about technology with young people, young adults, when they're disengaged? Is there some way you had a moment of being disengaged and there was an intervention? Mm. Do you think technology helps with that, or do you think it's just something that young people maybe, and older people yeah, get disengaged as well?
Yeah, I think it's a fine line because, so there's a lot of apps that do gamification, which I actually really like because I think all the medical apps are quite sad to look at. Like, you're not happy when you open them. You're like, okay, I guess I'll check. And there's a lot of startups that work on that and make it fun, especially for kids. Like, it's more like a little video game, you know, and if you're in range or if you do this and that, you get little prices or funny pop-ups on your screen. So it makes it, like, more engaging. At the same time, I think that we are overwhelmed with data. There's a lot of conversation. We need more data. We have this app so you can see your data. And I'm like, yeah, but you need to translate that into real actions because a lot of people actually don't want to sit and look at their data and not, they don't know what it means. I mean, now with the CGM, we got so many data points. Then you have your insulin pump. You can get like, you know, pages and pages of data, but that might also be disengaging because you don't even know where to start. So I think it's kind of like a fine line between making it more engaging and then making it a bit overstimulating somehow. But the gamification apps, I really like. There's some really cool ones out there. And I think for kids, that might be fun. I think teenagers is just again, when I've been there, when I was a teenager, I think a nap maybe wouldn't necessarily made it better. I think it's the realization that I do it for myself and my own well-being. And I guess when you're 13, you don't really think about what might happen when you're 60. Kind of has to click, I think, and then you're like, okay, I'm going to do this for myself.
There's been a lot of conversations around removing phones from schools in the UK and that they're distractions. And, of course, in the back of our minds is always like, well, what have you got, type 1 diabetes? I know there aren't that many maybe in the school, but I think there has to be some understanding that having the tech and having a phone is game-changing, life-changing.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, there's also, I think, some smartwatches and stuff. Sometimes, I'm not sure because I don't have one, you still need the phone for it to connect, but I guess that might also change. So it's not, I don't like the fact, for example, that I'm so dependent on my phone. When I was on, there's different pumps out there and some work without a phone and some, for some systems, you need the phone. And I don't like that at all because what if you lose your phone? You're traveling, you lose your phone, somebody steals your phone, and then you can't like manage this life-threatening condition. So I'm like, I get why it's a conversation we need to have, but I'm also, I don't love the fact that we're so dependent on our phones. I mean, right now I just have the Dexcom on my phone and I'm always out of battery. Yeah. And then, you know, I was sitting there the other day, I had like 5% battery left and I'm like, okay, I mean, if my phone dies, I will basically be blind when it comes to my blood glucose levels, so...
This came up in a recent webinar we did, and some people are now carrying two phones, one just for their tech and one as a phone.
Yeah, which I always need, I already need to think of so many extra things. I'm like, I don't want to carry two phones. Sometimes I wish I didn't have to carry any phone. And in a way, when I was on the pump, that was at least something that was, I couldn't lose it because it's literally had a needle in my skin. So in a way that made it easier and you could see the Dexcom on there and stuff, the blood glucose. So I quite like the fact that I wasn't so dependent on my phone. But I think tech will, you know, advance and then there might be solutions that are smoother as well when it comes to that.
Is there anything else you think we haven't talked about that you'd like to add at this point?
No, I think we've covered the things that are very close to my heart. And I just want to emphasize on the fact that every person is different. So every person's diabetes is different. And there's not one solution that will work for everyone.
But it's good to hear other people.
Yes, that's why we need the conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's why there shouldn't just be one solution on the market, but as many as possible to fit.
Excellent. Okay, well, thank you very much indeed.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
DRWF. Staying well until a cure is found.
You're listening to Living with Diabetes, the DRWF podcast, and our special series looking at some of the challenges facing women living with diabetes. You can find helpful guidance on all aspects of diabetes, together with details on how to support the charity, fundraising events, news and information on our website at drwf.org.uk. Thanks to all our guests who have helped us explore diabetes and women's health, and to you for joining us. Coming up next time, Vanessa Haydock, a body trainer and coach living with type 1 diabetes.
I just remember it taking about three nurses to give me my first insulin injection because I was not having any of it. I was so scared. And I'd try and really understand what was going on with my levels. I got into health and fitness. I just, you know, improved my overall habits and behaviours around my diabetes. The first step to any behaviour change is that acceptance. And acceptance is key when it comes to any condition, especially type 1 diabetes. And it's that acceptance that, okay, it's with me for life, but it's not going to stop me and it's not going to defeat me. You know, you look at the stats and it's, you know, we're 50% more likely to suffer from some form of mental health condition, which is it any wonder with the pressure that we're under? Diabetes burnout is a thing and it's not really something that's spoken about enough. And I always say, even to clients, you know, even I go through periods of burnout. I think the main thing is that when it comes to diabetes, everyone's journey with diabetes is different, and there's no such thing as perfection when it comes to diabetes.
This podcast has been supported by Abbott. Living with Diabetes is a Blue Aurora media production for DRWF. Copyright 2025. Diabetes Research and Wellness Foundation. All rights reserved.